From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. Dry conditions in California have made wildfire season last the whole year.
There's a very high likelihood of well above normal fires and perhaps a chance of longer lasting fires.
Also, a rescue worker talks about that gut-wrenching decision, when to call off the search.
When the probability of finding someone drops so low, there comes a point where you have to say we have to cut our losses for now.
And NFL prospect Michael Sam got a lot of attention for coming out, but what about his football skills?
I wouldn't just dismiss the possibility of him going undrafted. I think it's a real thing.
That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. It's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. The economy has been struggling for so long, the release of the government's monthly jobs report has turned into a somber ritual. But April's report, which came out yesterday, brought good news.
Okay, breaking news. The jobs numbers are a big story this morning.
288,000 jobs created.
The unemployment rate drops down to 6.3%.
Now, if you look out your window, you're not likely to see people dancing in the streets. Unemployment fell so sharply in part because 800,000 people dropped out of the labor force. Employers say there are still some jobs out there, and they're having a hard time filling them because the workers lack essential skills. And that's our cover story today, Bridging the Skills Gap. Of course, behind all those government statistics, there are real people, like Ricardo Coros. He's been a truck driver for years, but for him, the golden ticket would be working in an oil refinery. That shouldn't be a problem. There are 7 oil refineries operating right here in the L.A. area, but it's not so simple.
I didn't know how to get into a refinery.
Mm-hmm.
I heard it takes 3 years to get into the refinery itself. I didn't know the first step. There's online applications you can do, but out of all the emails, I don't think people are going to call you back unless you know somebody, a cousin or uncle, and I don't.
We'll get back to Ricardo in a bit, but first, more on the skills gap and his potential employers. The easiest time to get hired at a refinery is during what's called a turnaround. That's when they have to shut down for routine maintenance. Now, every second a refinery is shut down, money flies out the window. So companies want to do the turnaround as fast as possible. That requires hiring hundreds of people. But those workers require specific skills and need to hit the ground running. Here's Steve Martinez. He has to hire people to staff these turnarounds.
They need to have specialized training, particularly in safety protocols. And, of course, a lot of your general population, particularly looking for blue-collar work, are not going to have those requisite skills.
Martinez is in charge of West Coast hiring for a company called Veolia. Refineries hire his company to help with these turnarounds. He's mostly looking for what are called middle skill positions, jobs like safety attendants who watch to make sure everything is running smoothly and safely, hydroblasters, those are workers who clean out the inside of oil tanks, and special on-site truck drivers. All of these positions pay about $14 or $16 an hour and require special training and credentials. The jobs are grueling, and although Veolia has a good safety record, they're a lot more dangerous than working at Starbucks or Target. But the economy has been so bad that every time companies in the region would post a job, they'd get hundreds, even 1,000 applications. And even still, they were having trouble. Here's Martinez again.
We have recruited in the past from all sectors of the market, job market. We've seen a lot of candidates coming from different industries, but we still suffered with folks that were lacking some basic skills that we assumed, you know, the general population had a grasp on. We have found, you know, probably more cases than not that some of the employers that we've had lacked a certain level of computer skills, reading skills were low, and retention skills were low.
That right there is the skills gap. The Workforce Investment Act and other government programs are supposed to fill in that gap by helping to train workers, but often they don't work. A report from the Government Accountability Office back in December found that a full 80% of job training centers reported employers approaching them for help filling positions, but leaving empty-handed. That's exactly what Steve Martinez was seeing for years.
Because we weren't finding the right candidates to fill these positions, we were importing them from other parts of the country, you know, from our other locations, like in the Gulf of Mexico, in the Texas area. We'll import them, we'll house them, you know, we'll pay per diem for them. That gets expensive.
The Chevron refinery in El Segundo has a big turnaround coming up, but now they're looking for workers closer to home. Just outside of L.A., I join a couple dozen people who are training to be safety attendants during that Chevron turnaround and others going on this year. It's a group of men mostly, although I do see one woman among the trainees. They gather in clusters around three hands-on stations.
Give me the basic PPE that you're required to have on as a safety attendant.
A hard hat.
That's Ken Akbar. He's drilling one of the trainees on the necessary PPE, that's personal protective equipment.
Okay.
And your four gas meter.
Okay, and a reflective vest or reflective fluorescent vest because of high visibility, right?
Right, orange.
Ken Akbar is pointing now to a row of fire extinguishers, and beyond that, a big dark platform that contains a pool of liquid with a metal structure in the center.
What I want you to do is take that fire extinguisher and get over there. You're going to do a visual inspection of it to make sure your equipment is good. And then once you're comfortable that it is good, you're going to walk over and position yourself strategically where you think is best you need to be to put this fire out.
Okay.
When you're ready, just say ready, and then I'm going to light it for you.
The instructor flips a switch, and a fire flares out from the center of the platform.
Fire, fire!
The trainee takes a confident stance near the fire, not too near, and douses it with the extinguisher. He has it put out in about 10 seconds.
Good job.
Although it's entry level, it's a very important position.
This is Jason Vogel. He's the architect of this safety attendant training program.
Because if the safety attendant doesn't show up, well, then the craft workers can't work. So the welder, the carpenter, the pipe fitter, all those guys can't go in unless the safety attendant is there, and they still get paid. So
Vogel used to teach classes for the Occupational Safety and Health Administration at a nearby university. A few years ago, he heard about companies like Veolia shipping in refinery workers from the Gulf Coast and thought he could do better. He partnered up with a group called the Occupational Safety Councils of America, or OSCA, and asked the refineries directly what they were looking for.
The program was built from industry. We didn't build it and hope it met their standards. We had them build it, so we knew it met their standards.
Here's the other key part of the OSCA training. The program is set up under the umbrella of a California Community College district. That's crucial because the district is a government-approved training provider. In other words, they receive Workforce Investment Act dollars to train people looking for jobs, so those people don't have to pay out of pocket for all those classes. The government is paying to give people the training and credentials they need to get jobs the employers are desperate to fill. They're just entry-level jobs at first, but those credentials and training stick with them. Again, Jason Vogel.
We make sure they understand that if you take these courses, it doesn't mean you're automatically going to become the safety manager at the job site. But what it does is it gives you the training and the background where if you do a good job and you put your, you know, years of experience in, it opens up opportunities for you to have a safety career.
Back at the training, it's that prospect of a career that has the trainees excited. One of them is Ricardo Coros. You remember him from earlier.
I didn't know how to get into the refinery.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know the first step.
Ricardo started working as a truck driver after leaving the Army in 2004. It's frustrating, he says. Not much of a career ladder. It was when he was shuttling oil and waste between the refineries and the harbor that it struck him. The refinery workers had what he wanted.
A lot of them worked four on, four off, 12 hours a day. Hard work, but good money. And seemed like something I'd like to do for the rest of my life.
So would you have had a shot, do you think, if not for this program, not for this?
Not really. With no experience? No, I don't think so.
One of his classmates here today, Swanika Brown Johnson, has already gone out and paid for one of those necessary credentials. But she still can't find steady work either. And she tells me she can't afford to pay for any additional training.
It costs. The classes that I have taken already, they've cost me out of my pocket, either traveling to another state to take the classes, or either I went to Dominguez and I actually had to pay $750. So this is a big difference when you can take the classes for free compared to coming out your pocket to pay for it.
Brown Johnson has been underemployed for years. Now she's set to make $14 or $16 an hour, working 12-hour days every day until the turnaround is over in 2 or 3 months. And she's already dreaming of a promotion to a full-time refinery safety manager, a.k.a. a red hat.
A red hat is like the ultimate, like it's like a supervisor of all of the safety personnel. So you go and you do audits and you make sure everybody's following the rules of the refinery. And it's a nice place to be, you know, financially and, you know, just to be up there to walk around with a red hat and to know what you're doing and, you know, you're very respected.
Initially, her work as a safety attendant will only line up with the refinery turnarounds, so she'll have to wait to take classes in the off-season. But unlike before, she won't have to pay out of pocket for additional training. And she's more confident there will actually be work on the other side.
Actually, when I was standing in line on Monday to sign up to check in, I was like, I'm excited. Like, my heart was beating. I was just excited because I haven't did it in a while. And I enjoy myself out there. Like, it's something different.
After we first talked to her, we found out Soynika Brown-Johnson got a job with Irwin, a contractor similar to Veolia. And Ricardo Coros, the guy who couldn't find a way into the refinery industry, he got a job with Veolia. If things at the refinery go according to schedule, they'll both start working on Monday. These two people and most of the others in this program have found jobs that could turn into careers. But we're talking about a relatively small number of workers in one narrow slice of a big industry in one region of one state. A Government Accountability Office study in March reported that in 2011, hundreds of thousands of people used federal funds to pay for job training. But even the GAO has no idea how many of those people have landed jobs. Here in California, it is dry. According to the U.S. Drought Monitor, the entire state is in a state of drought. We're talking about an area bigger than Germany. And in a state already known for wildfires, the dry conditions are ripe for fast-growing, destructive blazes.
Take a look behind me. You can see the faint glow of the fire. Just to my left is the area where all of the emergency vehicles have come back to get these flames knocked down. Take a look.
This past week, a fire started near Rancho Cucamonga, California, and quickly grew to more than 2,000 acres. The air in the town was thick with smoke. Using fire engines and water-dropping helicopters, firefighters managed to contain the blaze, but it's a sign of the tough conditions here.
It is going to be, unfortunately, an above-average year in terms of large fire potential due to the ongoing drought.
That's Rob Crone. He's a fire weather meteorologist with the U.S. Forest Service.
I would say there's a very high likelihood of well above normal fires and perhaps a chance of longer lasting fires, which require more resources in order to fight them.
When we spoke, Crone used the phrase, quote unquote, fire season, because these days fire season lasts 12 months a year. And that means people who live in wildfire country have to prepare.
So where we're at is Mount Baldy.
This is Nathan Judy. He's the fire information officer for the Angeles National Forest. Recently, Nathan was showing me around the community of Mount Baldy. If you were to wake up on Mount Baldy, you'd be shocked to find out it's on the border of LA County, just an hour from downtown. The community is nestled under the peaks of the San Gabriel Mountains and surrounded by the green of pine trees and grasses. The thing is, in a normal year, Nathan told me, we should be seeing white.
Is it less snow than we would see typically this time of year?
Oh, yeah. Typically at this time of year, you'd have snow where we are right now.
That means more risk of fire.
With the drought that we've had last year into this year, fuels are ready. They're susceptible to burn.
Fuels, in this context, means grasses, brush, the trees that feed wildfires. And the reason we came to Mount Baldy was to see how the community is trying to mitigate that risk by cutting and gathering those fuels and burning them on their terms. Nathan drives us in his truck to the site of a controlled burn. Several fire trucks sit by the side of the road, and down below, dozens of firefighters are gathered with hoses and tools around burning piles of brush. The idea is if there's less fuel available to burn, it should at least slow down a fast-moving wildfire. Everyone is wearing light protective gear, helmets, orange or yellow fire-retardant shirts. Before we can get close to the fires, he offers us some gear, too.
Extra large.
And we climb down through the brush and smoke.
Walk over here on the outside of the hose line where these guys are working the pile.
Just keep flipping those timbers to the middle.
Woo!
Yeah, that's hot, huh?
Brush and grass. They've arranged those fuels in small, smoldering piles, a couple of feet high.
You can hear their tools in the ground scraping the dirt, moving that wood around to make sure it burns.
They use shovels and a tool called a McLeod. It's like a hoe with a blade on one side and metal teeth on the other. Several men hold hoses, and from time to time they spray the piles with water sending up plumes of smoke and steam. The flames aren't so high, but the heat is intense. I found it hard to stand close. Kevin Moran is watching one of those piles. He's a captain with the Dalton Hotshots, a crew specially trained to fight wildfires. He says he's been concerned about the dry conditions, but the only thing he can do himself is prepare.
Get my body right, let my family know what's going on, and they already know what to expect for the time that I've been doing it. And just get prepared. That's all we can do.
2013 was a terrible year for wildland firefighters like Kevin. In one incident, 19 members of the Granite Mountain Hotshots were killed fighting a wildfire in Arizona. We asked Kevin if that type of risk is on his mind this year.
Yes and no. Yes, it's on my mind that those things happen, but no, it's not going to affect my job and my duty that I have to do.
Back on the road, on the ridge above all the action, James Tomaselli stands watching. He's been with the Forest Service for 20 years, and he says he's happy they can do some of this prevention work. Because of some recent rains, the conditions today are slightly better, but it has been so dry these past few years that it just hasn't been safe enough to do a controlled burn.
These piles have been here for 3 years that we've been trying to burn them. Ideally, you cut them that year and you burn them the same year that you make them. And it's been 3 years before we've been able to get these piles burned. And there's a lot more out there like that.
The fire crews are doing this work for a simple reason: to help protect the several hundred people who live and work in Mount Baldy.
Hey, how are you doing? I thought that might be you.
Nathan Judy takes us to the Mount Baldy Lodge. Missy Ellingson has owned the lodge for 35 years. They have a restaurant, a bar, and rent out cabins to people visiting the National Forest or there skiing in the mountains. This season has been tough.
When you have a business in Southern California, it's edgy, you know?
Was there basically no ski season this year?
There was no ski season. We never opened for skiing. We opened for tubing a little bit, but it sucked.
Add to that the increased risk of fires. So this year, Missy says they decided to buy something called barricade gel.
Want to see a bottle of it?
Sure.
She goes behind the bar and comes back with a plastic gallon jug of a pink liquid.
You basically hook it up to a system that propels it.
Like an air compressor, which can then spray the fire retardant on the sides of a building and maybe keep the building from igniting.
Do you have a sense of how much you've spent on all these prevention measures and protection measures?
Well, three cases of this was $1,100, I can tell you that. Well, it's cheaper than losing your place for, you know, this is our life. This is our restaurant where we live. You know, this is everything we have.
Missy Ellingson tells me she has to put everything into prevention because should the lodge burn down, she wouldn't be able to rebuild. And she says anyone in Mount Baldy with a brain is doing the same thing, taking steps to prepare for wildfires. Because even in a region used to wildfires, this year appears poised to be especially destructive. Thanks again for listening. This is All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. What is there to say about saxophone colossus Sonny Rollins that hasn't already been said, when you consider that critics have been writing about him for over 60 years? But there is more to say, because over the decades, Sonny Rollins never stopped growing, adding to his sound. More than once, he stepped away from his adoring audiences for extended sabbaticals. He'd decide he wasn't good enough, take a couple of years off to practice and study, and come back when he felt ready. He's taking some time off again now, but that may be due more to the fact that he's 83 years old than a desire to rethink his music. In the meantime, Rollins has been leaking some live recordings for a series he calls Road Shows. Volume 3 comes out on Tuesday. Tell me, does this sound like a guy in his 80s? I talked with Sonny Rollins earlier this week, and I asked him why he's opting to release these live albums rather than working on something new.
Well, I got afraid of the recording studio. You know, I get a phobia about the lights, camera, action. And a lot of people tell me that in person with the audience and the ambiance, people tell me, well, gee, I like you better when you're live, Sonny, than I do on record. So I said, okay, that's easy. I've got a lot of live performances, and I can pick and choose and put some out, which was not so easy, actually. I'm very strict on myself. I don't like listening to myself. You know, I'm not a guy that goes home and puts on a Sonny Rollins record, you know. So it's sort of picking and choosing, therefore, can be quite excruciating.
I want to talk about one of the tracks on the new release on Roadshows Volume 3, the song called Patanjali. It's a new composition, or at least this is the first, I think, we've heard of it here. And that's the name of the great Hindu philosopher of yoga.
That's correct.
And you studied Indian philosophy and yoga in India. I can see how yoga, with its emphasis on breathing, could be even useful on a technical level for a saxophonist. What has yoga brought to your playing?
Well, you know, it's the concentration level. And a lot of people think of yoga as the exercises, which is one form of yoga, hatha yoga. There are four other main forms of yoga, and they are more contemplative, introspective, meditational. You see, the thing is this. When I play, what I try to do is to reach my subconscious level. So I don't want to think, overtly think about anything, because you can't think and play at the same time. You know, and believe me, I've tried it. You can't do it. It goes by too fast in the act of improvising. So when you're into yoga and when you're into improvisation, you want to reach that level, that other level.
When you went to India, you took, I guess, sort of a sabbatical from playing and from recording. What was it that triggered you to sort of reach out in these other directions in that way?
Well, I was into many things. I was into Rosicrucianism. I studied Buddhism, Kabbalah even. I was into really those philosophies of life, as were some of my colleagues. We were trying to find a way to express life through our improvisations. The music has got to mean something, you know, and this is a beautiful thing about music. I'm sure you understand that. Music means something besides just the surface melodies and blah, blah, blah. Jazz improvisation is supposed to be the highest form of communication. And getting that to the people is our job as musicians. You know, I'm not supposed to be playing. The music is supposed to be playing me. I'm just supposed to be standing there with the horn moving my fingers. The music is supposed to be coming through me. That's when it's really happening.
My guest is saxophone colossus Sonny Rollins. His latest album is called Roadshows Volume 3. I want to ask you, this is something I read on the internet, so maybe it's not true, but is this true that it was a Frank Sinatra concert that was a very key early inspiration for you?
Well, I was a big fan of Frank Sinatra's, and this was in the 40s. You know, they decided to try to have a school integration way back then. There was an Italian neighborhood, and of course we lived up on Washington Heights in a mainly minority neighborhood. Anyway, we came there, and of course it was a little bit of, you know, oh, who are these guys? Wow, they're coming to our neighborhood, blah, blah. You know, this human nature. But at any rate, Frank Sinatra came down to our school, and he did a concert. And he also preached to the kids that we're not supposed to be fighting each other. And of course, he was a god in the Italian neighborhood. And as I said, he was a musical hero to me as well. And what he did then was beyond music.
You talk about the political situation at that time, and I think about so much of your music that has heavy political overtones, things like, you know, the Freedom Suite.
I grew up with a very, very strong grandmother who was an activist, a political activist. She used to take me with her on some of these marches. You know, we used to march for the Scottsboro Boys and Paul Robeson and all of these progressive causes. So I grew up with that. You know, it wasn't anything strange for me to do the Freedom Suite. Because it was, you know, I believe in equality. I realize it's not going to happen in many ways, maybe never, but that's not the point. I believe that it should happen. So I expressed it through my way of communicating to people, my music.
It's hard to think of anything you haven't accomplished in terms of music, but is there something else out there that you still want to do that you haven't done?
Well, I know there's always something to do. There's always things that I've thought about, nature recordings, and listening to new people coming up, these young people, and being able to relate to them. So music is an open sky. It's vast. I would never say, well, gee, I've done it and it's up. No, no way. I wouldn't be so foolish as to ever feel that there isn't more music to be done, because it is out there, and I want to do it.
That's Sonny Rollins. The latest in his Roadshow series comes out on Tuesday. Sonny Rollins, thank you for all of the great music over the years. I can't thank you enough.
Well, it's been a pleasure, and I'm very happy that I made a fan along the way.
To say the least. If you're just joining us, it's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. What connects the films Drugstore Cowboy, Pet Sematary, Batman Forever, and Frida? You can skip Kevin Bacon and connect them all with just one name, composer Elliot Goldenthal. Here he's evoking a jittery sense of dread in Alien 3. Goldenthal is like a wizard when it comes to creating distinct musical atmospheres. He won an Oscar for his Mexican-tinged score for Frida, but he's equally at home working on a cop drama like Michael Mann's Heat. But Goldenthal has not abandoned his roots in traditional composing. This coming week, Goldenthal will premiere a new work in an odd key, Symphony in G-sharp minor. The Pacific Symphony in Costa Mesa, California, will perform the symphony. Goldenthal told me that this key, G-sharp minor, has held a kind of fascination for him since he was a kid growing up in Brooklyn.
Growing up as a boy, as a child, 6, 7, 8 years old, we had a spinet in my apartment. And the best note on a whole piano was A flat or G sharp. All the other keys sounded flimsy for me. And also, psychologically and weirdly enough, we're used to hearing A natural. When we go into a concert hall, the oboe player tunes up the orchestra in A natural. Everywhere else in the United States, when we open up a refrigerator and stand under a light or a neon sign, we constantly hear the key of around B flat. The cycles of the frequency is in that key. So you have B flat all day, until you go into a concert hall and then you hear A. So hearing a A flat or G sharp, it has a darkness and a kind of a rebelliousness and warmth at the same time.
Making things harder on your orchestra, though, right? That's what, like five sharps?
Yeah. No, it's not that hard. They're not babies, you know, they're professional musicians.
I'm thinking of my own musicianship. You also have a couple of recordings out right now. One of them, Othello, it's an adaptation from your ballet. I'm wondering, how exactly do you transform ballet music into a symphony?
Well, for one thing, it's not programmatic, so all narrative references to the story is discarded. And what we have left is a two-hour piece, a full evening of music, rarefied down to its orchestral components.
So with Othello, you wanted to go a bit more abstract and just go with the emotions?
No, I wouldn't say emotions. I would say motives, where the motivic building blocks of the piece have more of a story to tell than Mr. Bill Shakespeare.
So the music that people might know you best is from the film Frida. Of course, you won an Oscar for that. You use traditional Mexican instruments and we're trying to evoke that place. I imagine that's got to be a tricky thing, though, trying to sound authentic, but obviously you're not of that culture.
Well, I sound authentic until you play it for authentic musicians. They say, oh, we don't do that. Through a lot of affection and admiration that I approached that score. It wasn't put on a sombrero and drink a margarita and think you can write anything authentically Mexican. Although it's authentically me admiring the aesthetic of Mexican regional music.
If you look over your work, and especially including the body of film work, you've composed in just about every kind of style I can imagine. I'm curious, when you're sitting at home, what kind of music do you listen to?
Well, I listen to world music. I don't center on a station.
But you grew up in Brooklyn. I have to imagine there were a lot of sounds, a lot of different types of music when you were growing up.
A lot of sounds. I lived in a multicultural environment. And my bedroom is on a court, sort of surrounded by everyone who had a phonograph playing everything from soul to salsa to Haitian music and opera. So I was a world traveler in one small apartment.
Elliot Goldenthal, thanks so much for being with us.
I really had a good time.
Composer Elliot Goldenthal's Symphony in G-sharp minor has its world premiere with the Pacific Symphony this coming week. He also has two new recordings out right now, the Othello Symphony and String Quartet No. 1, The Stonecutters. A search and rescue mission for landslide victims in a remote village in northeastern Afghanistan has been called off. Estimates vary, but there may have been more than 2,000 people who were buried Friday by mud and rock. It's likely the site will simply become a mass grave. Closer to home, the active search for victims of the Washington State mudslide was called off last week.
More than a month after search and rescue workers began working, two people are still missing. Sheriff Ty Trenary made the announcement Monday.
This has been a difficult decision because I know that Chris and Steve's families are both looking for closure.
As much as everyone wants closure, sometimes officials have to make the gut-wrenching call on when it's time to give up. Sean Roundy is a member of the Utah County Sheriff Search and Rescue Team.
When the probability of finding someone drops so low, and when everyone has already expended so much of their life in the process, searching and searching for days and weeks, there comes a point where you have to say we have to cut our losses for now.
His team is called out to comb snowy mountains after avalanches and find lost and injured people in Utah's caves, rivers, and lakes. Over 14 years with the team, he's become familiar with a sense of not knowing.
I think there's a lack of that satisfaction that you're looking for as you search, you're hoping for so intensely all this time. There's a sense of disappointment that you haven't succeeded yet, and the awareness that the survivors of these people, their family and friends and neighbors, that they're left hanging, and we hate to see that happen.
And when you have to do that, you've been thrown into the situation, you know, emotionally and physically so intensely. Does that stay with you? Is that search still on your mind when you have to move on?
Absolutely. In fact, we've always eventually found the people we were searching for, but sometimes it took as long as 6 months. And when that happens, then every time you're in that vicinity, you just wonder, where is that person and when will we find them?
You had a situation where you were trying to rescue some people who were buried in a series of avalanches on Christmas Day. How did you get to a point where you determined that further searching was pointless?
We had a large, about a 40-acre search area, actually seven avalanches that came down in a row, and three people were buried and lost. And we found one within a couple of days. We found one weeks later. But at some point, we had crisscrossed this whole avalanche multiple times with our 9-foot aluminum probe, shoving them down into the snow. We had had dogs go everywhere, and we had ground-penetrating radar dragging back and forth across, mapping the layers of ice and tree branches and everything. And once we'd covered it so many times, there's really nothing more we could do until the snow melted down deeper. That final one, it took until Easter Sunday. And it turns out that one of my students, I was teaching English at the university at the time, had been hiking by and they saw a glove protruding from the snow. And a friend went over and pulled it up and said, oh, look, a glove, and lifted it up. And then there was a hand, so they called 911.
Do you have to deal with, say, the families who might be understanding, of course, that the search may not make sense, but they're going to want it to keep going on, right?
In those situations where we've been going for like over a week, I think they're usually really quite understanding. You know, we have to put our safety first. That's mm-hmm. what all emergency services are trained in, because otherwise you're not around to save other people in the future.
You know, there's this really uneasy aspect to this because, you know, we're talking about equations in a way, balancing risk, looking at the odds. But, of course, you're dealing with people's lives.
Yeah.
Do you deal with the emotional side of that in training for this kind of work?
You know, we don't get a lot of training in that. But after something goes wrong or we bring out a fatality, it does have an emotional toll. And we need to be careful. So often we'll have a critical incident stress debriefing afterward just to make sure people have an opportunity to vent. Chris Johnson, one of my mentors on search and rescue, early in his rescue career, he went up on an avalanche. There was one fatality there and then someone else who was injured. And as they were working, another avalanche swept down and hit them, and they were all okay. They got him down to the ambulance, and it wasn't over yet, because as they were driving away in the ambulance, an avalanche from the other side of the canyon hit the ambulance. And at some point, sitting in the ambulance, he looked at this man, the deceased one, and he realized he had the same pant shell, the same boots, about the same age, and he realized, wow, that could have been me. Mm. Now, it continued to affect him even later, because about a week later, he woke up in the middle of the night with a panic attack. He could hardly breathe. He just curled up into the fetal position and cried, just sobbed. So it really can have quite a serious effect on us.
Sean Roundy is a member of the Utah County Sheriff Search and Rescue Team. He's written a book about his experiences, including some of what we talked about just now. It's called 75 Search and Rescue Stories. Sean, thank you.
You're welcome. Nice talking to you.
And if you're just joining us, this is All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. Climate change is melting polar ice at an alarming rate. While this terrifies many people, especially those living near sea level, some businesses are seeing an opportunity, a big opportunity. According to the National Snow and Ice Data Center, the year-round ice cover in the Arctic is now half the size it was in the 1980s, and previously inaccessible natural resources are now there for the taking. Isaac Arnsdorf writes about energy and commodities for Bloomberg News. He says it starts with oil.
The Arctic is estimated to have about a quarter of the world's undiscovered oil and gas. But it's not just that. There's diamonds and gold and zinc and copper and just about all the natural resources you can imagine. Some investors are describing it as if a whole new continent was discovered.
What are investors putting into this to try to get those riches out?
Companies are expected to spend $100 billion in the next decade. There's been mining and drilling for oil in the Arctic for decades, but this is really an unprecedented level of investment that's expected to come on in the next few years because of the pace of climate change.
And what are they going to be doing with that $100 billion investment?
Well, there's not much there to begin with, so there's a lot of basic infrastructure that you need to start with in order to have that kind of industrial development. There's just one highway connecting the northern slope of Alaska with the rest of North America. So, you know, no matter what kinds of minerals you plan on extracting, getting those to market present a lot of logistical challenges. And then there's the actual development costs of drilling oil wells or digging mines.
And what about the issues around who has the rights to all the vast and valuable resources?
Well, the Arctic is split among the countries with territory in the area. So the U.S., Canada, Denmark because of Greenland, Norway, Iceland, and Russia. There are some disputes on their maritime borders. Another layer on top of that is about 4 million people who live in the region, many of them indigenous people whose heritage dates back thousands of years.
Now, not everybody is wanting to jump headfirst into this opportunity. In fact, you quote some fairly skeptical investors. What's holding them back?
Well, many people still regard this as a very frontier place. You know, even as investors are calling it an emerging market or a frontier market, it still sounds pretty far-fetched to a lot of people who are very aware of the difficulties of operating in that environment. While the climate is changing and the ice is receding, standard industrial practices that are used all over the world haven't been tried in that environment. And in some cases, they think they couldn't succeed in that environment. That makes a lot of investors concerned about the potential losses if these projects don't work out or if there's an accident, if there's a catastrophe like the Exxon Valdez. And environmentalists are warning, how can you plan to operate in an area where you don't have a contingency plan?
And speaking of the environment, obviously people are just lining up to point out the irony.
Of course.
That ice that's been cleared by climate change, allowing companies to dig for more fossil fuels. Do any of the companies have anything to say about that?
Absolutely. It's a tremendous irony. And the companies that have been at the front of the pack in terms of developing the Arctic have been careful about emphasizing their sustainable practices and working with the people who live in the areas about trying to minimize the environmental damage. But absolutely, and it's especially a concern for the people who live there who are trying to balance the potential income and what they have to gain from the extraction of those resources with the risks that it could pose to their traditional ways of life.
That's Isaac Arnsdorf. He reports on energy and commodities for Bloomberg. Isaac, thank you.
Thank you.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Arun Roth. A few years ago, the cartoonist Matt Friedman started having nagging pain around his ear.
I lived with ear pain in my left ear for years, it seemed like. It would come and go, and I would go to various doctors and be told it was ordinary pain. It got appreciably worse, I think, over the summer of 2012, to the point where sort of half my head felt like it was on fire occasionally.
He tried mouth guards and painkillers. Nothing really worked.
And then a little bump popped up on my neck, and I was so convinced that this was part of this sort of continuing earache that I just thought it was another manifestation of that.
Finally, Matt's family convinced him to see a doctor who told him it was not a benign earache. It was cancer. He had tumors in his neck and lungs. The cancer was slow growing, but still life-threatening. The doctor described it with a phrase that resonated with Matt: relatively indolent, but relentless. That became the title of his new book, a journal he kept over 60 days of cancer treatment.
I think a lot of people who have this particular kind of cancer, which is, as they say, indolent and yet relentless, you know, live with it for a long time because it creeps up on them slowly like a slowly boiling frog. You don't jump out till it's a little too late.
And giving you the title of the journal, Relatively Indolent but Relentless. It's an odd and ominous phrase.
Right. As soon as, you know, when I went in and saw that phrase, even with the qualifier relatively, it was like, oh, that's me. You know, it's not quite the extreme of anything, not quite as alert and aggressive as I should be, but, you know, get the job done slowly. And it turns out that that's going on at a cellular level as well, so for better or worse.
So you're prescribed a treatment regimen of radiation therapy and chemotherapy. Where did the idea for writing this journal come from?
Well, I'm an artist and a writer, and I've used a kind of incremental writing process and drawing process over the years to sort of accumulate material that would be, since I'm too indolent to create in a spurt, I have to be relentless and produce them over time. I didn't think of it as a book or a journal to share, but simply as a kind of experience, a sort of souvenir of some sort, I suppose.
And it looks to me what I imagine an artist's journal would look like. There are notes and some journaling and rough drawings along the side. Let's take a page from the journal to give our listeners a sense. Let's go to day 10, October 23rd. Can you describe what you write and draw for our listeners?
Okay. One of the things that I was always worried about was that people, doctors, and you know, everybody's trying to help me sort of deal with the sort of arc of treatment, saying that, you know, it's going to get worse, so prepare yourself. And so part of my mind was always wondering about that. So this is the way this page is lined up. It's on, you know, on the left side, there's a cliff that reaches from the top of the page to the bottom, and there's a little figure who's clearly the author falling off the cliff. And then all the way down to the bottom are various images that were sort of characteristic of the problem I was having. My tongue was beginning to really burn. I was getting a dry spot and sharp pain, so there's a kind of disembodied tongue about three-quarters of the way up with a nail in the tip. Then below that, the food has become inedible. A banana tastes like battery acid, so there's a peeled banana. Spaghetti tastes like a rake. The textures of things became quite difficult to deal with as much as the taste. And then below that are sort of stormy waves. So I was sort of imagining that I had finally fallen off the cliff, but of course I had a long way to go, and what I didn't realize is that I was sort of falling into a new kind of rhythm, a new temporary normal.
And over the course of this, as your state of mind changes, or even maybe your sense of self seems to change over the course of it, it's reflected in the drawings and even in your handwriting.
Yeah, that's very true. That's part of what I thought was important about the book once I started to think about it as a way to communicate experience and talk in a larger sense about what it means to go through a treatment like this, that it's not just the pictures, but I'm glad that you see it that way, because it was important to me that the writing be part of the page, that you have to actually sort of look at the letters and how they change.
And you get this sense as you get into it, where you talk about this sense of separation between the people who are afflicted like you and the healthies. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I hope that wasn't a little too self-indulgent at the time, but I think part of the process of kind of withdrawal from the world, or sort of descending into the experience of being sort of deeply enmeshed in the treatment, is that you do, at least I felt a weird kind of disconnect from the world in a way I didn't expect, in a way I wasn't particularly proud of, but things were happening, big things were happening around the world, and part of me just sort of almost reflexively thought, well, that's not my problem now. My problem is that I'm sick, you know, and those people are, everybody else is wrecking the world, but I'm doing my job by just growing tumors and being treated for tumors, and that the healthies have screwed everything up and I'm not responsible. It's not, I don't know why that is. I suppose it was just a way of giving myself permission.
How is your health now? It's been close to a couple of years since that treatment. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. I mean, as one of the first doctors said, this is a non-curative disease. So you want to treat it like a chronic disease as much as you can. The treatment for my head and neck were wonderfully effective so far. Nothing's come back. the tumors in my lungs didn't grow quite as slowly as we hoped, but, you know, they are indolent, even if they are relentless. So the trick is to stay alive as long as possible and hope somebody invents something. And that, so far, I'm doing my end of the bargain.
Well, wish you the best. Matt Friedman's book is called Relatively Indolent But Relentless, A Cancer Treatment Journal. Thank you so much for sharing this with us.
Well, thanks for talking.
This week, the NFL will hold its annual draft of college players. And if one name has risen beyond the sports pages, it's Michael Sam, who will become the first openly gay player in an NFL locker room. Last season at the University of Missouri, Sam was an All-American and the co-defensive MVP of the toughest conference in college football. But some draft watchers say there's a chance Michael Sam won't be drafted at all. Here's NPR producer Phil Harrell.
For each position, the NFL looks for certain ideal physical traits. Quarterbacks should have 10-inch hands. Wide receivers should run a 40-yard dash in under 4.6 seconds. Well, Michael Sam played defensive end in college a full 3 inches shorter and 20 pounds lighter than the NFL prototype, likely too small to succeed in the pros, they say. And as he showed in recent workouts, he appears too unathletic to convert to the more fleet linebacker position. The NFL has a word for that.
He's a tweener. He's a classic tweener.
Or someone caught between two positions. That was Daniel Jeremiah. He's a former NFL scout for three different teams. He's now one of the analysts on the NFL Network's Path to the Draft. He says scouts have to look past college production, despite Michael Sam's leading the Southeastern Conference in quarterback sacks.
Although it's good college football, it's not the NFL. He's not going to be able to overpower some of these NFL tackles the way he did at Missouri. If I was going to guess, the chances are more likely he will get drafted in that sixth, seventh round. But I wouldn't just dismiss the possibility of him going undrafted. I think it's a real thing.
That would mean 256 players would be chosen instead of Michael Sam. Beyond whatever physical limitations he may have, there's also the question of how an NFL locker room will receive its first openly gay player. Now, publicly, most players have said they'd welcome him. But some have expressed concern. In an interview with the NFL Network's Andrea Kramer before Michael Sam's announcement, former Saints linebacker Jonathan Vilma wondered if a theoretical openly gay player would fit in.
Imagine if he's the guy next to me and, you know, I get dressed naked, taking a shower, the whole nine, and it just so happens he looks at me. How am I supposed to respond?
Vilma has since clarified that statement. He says he'd be fine with a gay teammate, but since the NFL hasn't been put in that situation before, he wonders how it will affect locker room cohesion. Well, consider Sam's impact in college.
He debunked a bunch of different myths.
Wade Davis is a former pro who came out as gay after his playing career was over. He's been advising the NFL on diversity issues. Davis points out that Michael Sam came out to his Missouri teammates before last season started, and they finished with a 12-2 record and won the Cotton Bowl. Also, consider where he played.
We often think that the Midwest and the South are homophobic. That school formed a human barrier around him when the Westboro Baptist Church showed up, right? So I think that when we look at the Michael Sam story, we can go, wow, we may have this wrong.
Nevertheless, Sports Illustrated found 8 unnamed coaches and executives who said that Michael Sam's coming out will negatively affect his draft stock. At least 6 teams have expressed genuine interest in signing Sam, though, as the Baltimore Sun reports. Whether or not he's drafted, Michael Sam will be in an NFL camp this summer. And earlier this year, when he came out publicly to ESPN's Chris Connolly, he made his case.
I am a team player. I can make plays. I can help teams win games. And that's all that should matter.
Phil Harrell, NPR News.
It's time now for our series, My Big Break, about triumphs big and small. This next story comes from comedian Kurt Braunohler, and it's about a big break that might have been. Let's just leave it at that for now. The story starts a few years back when Kurt was in L.A. and struggling to get work in comedy. That's when he got a call from his manager.
First he said, do you speak German? And like my joke on stage is that I realize I look like the IT guy from the Nazis, but weirdly I don't speak German. And he's like, okay, and he hangs up and he calls back and he's like, can you speak with a German accent? And I was like, well, like a comedically bad one. And he hangs up again and he calls back. He's like, okay, I've got an audition for you. And I'm like, this is going to be a disaster.
Hey,
show up at the audition, and the first audition is just with the casting director, who's a very awesome lady. I improvise in this terrible German accent with her.
Well, what are we going to do tonight? We're going to have some fun? You know, like, it's terrible. Like, German people are like, what is that?
And that goes well, and then at the end of that, the casting director just says to me, do you speak any German? And I'm like, oh, you know, a little bit. I speak a little bit of German. And then she says, well, okay, well, would you speak some German to me? And so I know she doesn't speak German. So then I just make up some German-sounding words to her and put them together. Ein kleiner wie heißen Schwarten, wie auf den Futen son, wie ein kleiner als Wiedersehen. She's like, great, you know, we're going to bring you back tomorrow. And then at that point, she's like, do you know what this is for? And I was like, no. And she said, this is for you to play the assistant to Sacha Baron Cohen in the new Bruno film. For those of you who don't know who Sacha Baron Cohen is, he's like Ali G. He was Borat. And I was like, this is it. You come out to L.A. for 2 weeks, and then you get your big break, and then you're a movie star. Like, and I really did not anticipate what would happen. So the very next day, I show up, and there are like 35 people in there. Behind a big wooden desk is Sacha Baron Cohen. And the very first thing that the director says to me is, we understand you can speak fluent German. And I just look at him, and I'm like, yeah, I do. And he's like, great. Well, we're just going to have you start off by speaking some German with Sacha. And so then Sacha Baron Cohen, my comedy idol, looks at me and just speaks to me in German, which to me sounds like a series of whistles and clicks. And I just look him dead in the eye with a big smile. And I just say, wie heißen zwei in Weizen's 14, auf Wiedersehen the omelet, the Osen the 14 sehen. And then with a big smile, just look around at all the producers like, huh? Sasha looks at me like a dog who just heard like a whistle. Like he's confused, as he should be, because I have just walked in to essentially the biggest job interview of my life. And when asked a simple question like, so tell me about your resume, I've looked him dead in the eye and just gone, and then smiled at everyone in the room like an insane person. So he is confused, as he should be. And then he kicks it over to a producer who is straight up German. I remember him saying Muzzle und Faza, I think. And I just remember looking at him and just saying, nein. He probably said, what's the name of your mother and father? And I just went, no. And the director is like, well, thank you. We have you on tape. Which means get out. And the casting director, bless her heart, she speaks up, you know, like he's really great at improvising. And Sasha, and the director was like, okay, well, I guess we'll have you get up and improvise with Sasha. And I was like, in English? He's like, in English. I was like, okay. And then I just get up and Sasha just begins to denigrate me and have me do humiliating things, which is his character and how he treats, you know, his assistant in the movie. And at one point, Sasha takes his glasses off and he says, clean my glasses. I just instinctually, first impulse, reach for them with my mouth, like to grab them in my mouth. And then I licked his glasses all the way around and he totally broke. It was just like, clean those off. Like this was the end of the audition for him. That was it. Like, I was kicked out at that point. That was definitely the end of the audition. But to my memory, there was a moment where he no longer was Bruno, but that was Sasha telling me to clean off those glasses. So no matter how awful that was, there was a moment that I do believe Sacha Baron Cohen broke because he hated me just that much. So at least I can put that on my belt. hatred of my idol.
Kurt Brownoler may not have gotten that part, but you can find his podcast on iTunes. It's called The K-O, and his latest comedy album is called How Do I Land? We want to hear about your big break. Send us an email at mybigbreak@npr.org. For the week ending May 4th, 2014, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Chris Keneally, Becky Sullivan, and Daniel Hajek. Patrick Murray is technical director with technical support from Marcia Caldwell and Leo DeLacqua. Muthoni Muturi is our senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. Remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.